writer-director Turk Pipkin of the documentary Nobility next on The Culture Catch. Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at Final Draft. If you're looking to write a screenplay, FinalDraft.com has the software. And our friends at Script Magazine, serving screenwriters since 1989. You can visit them at ScriptMag.com. That's ScriptMag.com. Joining me today on The Culture Catch, I guess you'd call him a Renaissance man, Turk Pipkin from Austin.
Does that mean I'm going to get the Black Plague and die screaming a Renaissance man? That sounds scary.
Well, you know, maybe after people screen the movie, they may conject that it's something else other than some forward plague that we've yet to encounter.
Well, yeah, I'll ask Dr. Varmus when he's here tonight.
Yeah, exactly. Turk, I guess any filmmaker wants to know, you know, what was the inspiration for this new documentary and why spend so much of your career pursuing it?
Yeah, what career? I've given it up for the documentary. Now, I had a good one for a while for the documentary and the nonprofit. Well, Nobility, it's, you know, it's a look at the world's problems based on interviews with Nobel laureates. And I think that I was actually right in tune with a large percentage of the population right now, which is what in the heck is going on out there? I really wanted to find some reliable information about where the world's headed. I'm a dad. I've got two daughters, and a lot of it came from that perspective of being a parent. But certainly, I didn't feel that I could rely upon information that comes from, you know, the media, the government, or corporations, you know, the business world, as being, you know, 100% reliable for, you know, questions like global warming, which is our starting point, but, you know, bigger issues of war and peace and a lot of other things. So I thought, okay, Nobel laureates.
And what was the start time? I mean, did you have this idea that, and it took a while to reach the shooting stage?
I've been trying to figure out how to get into the questions, I guess, for my daughters from that point of view. The older they got, the more we started talking about this. They'd ask questions, and I'd go, yeah, let me get back to you on that. And literally, Steve Weinberg, who is the first laureate in the film, physics cosmologist, I met Weinberg in Austin, and I'd read his books and continue to read his books on theoretical physics, was trying to strike up these conversations about string theory, and he'd always come back with that famous retort of, that's not even wrong, when I would ask if I was right in describing string theory. But Weinberg became much more engaged with me, actually, as the film shows, you know, when my daughter found this fossil, this beautiful fossil, and gave it to a friend of ours. We were at her birthday party, and Weinberg was there, and he said, oh, that's really beautiful. He said to my, you know, then I think she was 10 or 11, said, you know how old that is? And she said, maybe 90 million years, 95, and he went, that's right. He came up to me and said, you know, your daughter's really smart. And that's when we started to talk about issues, and I learned that he was a poet, and that he stages Shakespeare readings in his home, and that's when I thought, hey, I could ask a theoretical physicist to give me a common sense approach to global warming, and you just couldn't beat that.
So. Well, that's a fantastic start point. So, yeah. How many years ago was that?
Was probably 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah, and I probably spent then another year of research and a year of shooting and a year of editing.
And once you had him on board, did you find it a little easier to get some of the former Nobel Prize winners to...
You know, people, I think the laureates wanted to participate. I worked very hard. Persistence was a lot of the key, but I worked very hard to convince them that I wouldn't waste their time, both while we were shooting that they could walk in the room and we would be having a conversation on camera, whatever we talked about, from then till the minute they walked out, and that it wouldn't be a big inconvenience for them. I know they have unbelievably busy schedules, and that I could get out there and find an audience for the film. It doesn't do any good to give me interview time if nobody ever sees it.
Right.
So I convinced them that I could do something with it. But like Tutu, I know that when Tutu was, he was on a book tour in the U.S. I didn't go to South Africa to interview Tutu, and I did that one in the States. But I, you know, his publicist told me they had 350 requests from one leg of that tour for media interviews, and we were essentially the only on camera.
Really?
Yeah. And I just, why we got it, I don't know. He, but he's fantastic. So
sometimes the serendipitous nature or the synchronicity of a project can inspire somebody to say yes when typically they might, or it got through to them. Oftentimes, as you know, the request never gets through unless you get right to the
person.
Well,
that's their persistence, you know.
Just don't take no for an answer till you hear it from that person.
And keep going to, I don't know, keep going to more people. It's persistence. It ends up being one of the theme words in the film. You know, each of the laureates has a theme, and it's actually Wangari Maathai's, the theme of her interview and her segment on the Greenbelt Movement, her tree planting group, and women's empowerment movement in Kenya. Persistence is the theme word of basically that piece of the film. So I thought it was interesting how it just naturally everybody came around to a word. Ahmed Zewail, Egyptian chemist who's in the film and speaks a lot about East-West relations, and his is knowledge. And but all of those things ended up being the keys of how I built the film.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can't go have these conversations unless you start from a point of view of a certain amount of knowledge. You don't know what to ask.
Right, right. So you have to do research, like anything. And then,
and you can't address these problems unless you're working. And knowledge, I'd say, is probably the overview of what this movie is all about, is that, you know, we're looking at where the world's going and how are we going to address it. And we have to address it more from a point of view of knowledge and less from a point of view of, you know, too much commerce, too much politics, too much, you know, individual bias, too much favor of one nation or one people or one religion over another.
Right.
Knowledge.
Well, I think that seems to be the central theme on a lot of the new documentaries in this field. We're kind of looking at them from a nonpartisan standpoint, which they should be. You know?
You know, I've had a lot of Republicans come see this movie. I mean, you'd say, oh, it's a movie about world problems. That's a bunch of liberal twaddle,
right.
You know. And I've had a lot of Republicans. We worked very hard to have this be a movie that would, you know, the idea was, I mean, my kind of general idea was that we have these political walls built up between us as, you know, conservatives and liberals, or red states or blue states, or Americans and some other country, or, you know, Christians and Muslims, whatever it is. Our whole lives were just walls.
Right.
And my idea was to climb up over the walls, and if we took the longer-term view, the 50-year view of these problems, then we'd see that the problems are so big, that the problems that we share are so big, that these differences between us that keep us from getting anything done would shrink away, and we would see that we really do share the problems. And what I've generally found is Republicans have exactly the same response to the movie that Democrats do, and conservatives as liberals. So,
well, you know, one of my personal favorite mantras is the Native American maxim that, you know, every decision you make affects seven generations ahead, and certainly this movie is examining that as the present, regardless of the future impact.
Yeah, and if children young enough, you could almost get seven generations in that 50 years.
Yeah, maybe,
but,
right?
Yeah, I think it's clear that they do, and I think it's clear, you don't even have to talk to Nobel laureates to see that we're not heading in a very good direction.
Yeah.
And, you know, then the question is, you know, how dire are these problems, and then is there something we can do about them? And you know, ultimately, it's a kind of an optimistic film, much to my surprise when it was all done. But, you know, one laureate after another, when I said, are you optimistic, are you hopeful? And they all said, absolutely.
The ingenuity of man and the ability to overcome tremendous odds.
But, you know, they're all saying, if we get to work now and
right.
we, you know, start to do the things we need to do, and we press forward with them. And they're not, you know, they're not decisions that are, they're not solutions that are going to take place because of individuals or because of corporations or NGOs or nations or alliances of nations. Their solutions are going to take place because of all of those things.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm just one person, my family. There's four of us actually in this little quest. And you know, we feel like we're having actually a pretty positive impact. We are getting a lot of feedback. I received an email recently from a group, a nonprofit that was inviting me to a fundraiser for a well or for a water project and a well drilling project for a Maasai village in Kenya. And so here I am, a movie I filmed in Kenya. I'd been filmed in a Maasai village, not that one. And my nonprofit, the Nobility Project, nobility.org, the Nobility Project is building a water system at a Kenyan school that I filmed at over there because I found out these kids didn't have water, and I could remember Nobel Peace Laureate Jody Williams saying, pick an issue that's important to you and get off your ass and get to work on it. So I said, okay, we'll build a water system for your school, and here's another one in Kenya. So I emailed back and said, I'll make a donation. I'll come to your fundraiser. It sounds fantastic. And I'll bring a copy of the movie. Maybe you can put it in an auction or you can get some extra money for that. Have you seen Nobility? And the lady emailed back and said, well, have I seen Nobility? That was why we founded this nonprofit.
Oh, that's so fantastic.
I'm just finding that people see the movie and they say, okay, what do I do? And, you know, that's why we have the nonprofit, to kind of steer them to things. But a lot of them are taking initiative.
And I think that's an important thing for people that are watching this. You can screen this movie. It's very inexpensive to host the movie, which makes it an easy fundraiser for anyone, even in the smallest community.
Yeah, yeah. The movie's out there. I mean, Landmark Cinemas is open in some markets. We're about to open in Boston and New York with Landmark. But anybody can go to the distributor's site, which is nobelitythemovie.com. And Nobel is like Nobel Prize, N-O-B-E-L-I-T-Y.
Thank you for making that distinction.
Themovie.com. Well, it's a play on words from nobility, right. So a lot of people pronounce it that way. But Nobility, the movie, and right on the main page, it's, you know, host a screening. You click on it. There's an online contract. You basically agree to charge $10 and send half of it to the distributor, and you're in the movie business. And you can show it in your home, but, I mean, most people who show it. It's churches, colleges, nonprofits. Some of them are just regular movie theaters, and they sign up to do it that way. It's easier than going to some, you know, big movie corporation. You just go right to the guys who own it. And theirs have been great. I've been to a lot of those screenings.
You know, that's a fantastic way of using the internet. Again, you know, you can eliminate the middleman, the distributor, which is, you know, tough for them, but you can get the message out there in a very clever way, just like the elections have used money from the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's the movie business on the honor system, and I like that. I mean, who is it out there I don't trust? I mean,
as an actor, you know all too well.
So, well, I don't trust my fellow actors, but I trust everyone else. I know they'll steal the scene from me.
Right.
Not
right.
Really. Yeah, some of those have been great. I actually talk about my daughter, her wildlife rescue group. She has a group called Wild Things. It's a bunch of teenage girls who do habitat restoration and wildlife rescue work. And they hosted two screenings in Austin and were sold out. And I think they charged $25 a pop or something. They made a lot of money. They paid for a big trip to go do habitat restoration in Big Sur this summer.
That's fantastic.
Had a show in the movie twice and had great Q&As with the audience.
Right.
And, you know, we're like a lot of high school kids talking about this stuff.
What a hands-on. Again, it's the internet. It's the ability to transmit this information.
Yeah.
and really share in the whole community of it.
Well, our nonprofit, you know, I mean, one of the things that, I mean, the Nobility Project, we call it an action and an education nonprofit. And the, you know, the action stuff is easy. You know, we're building a water system in Kenya, and I'm working with a group called the Miracle Foundation who builds orphanages in India. But the education part is probably the bulk of our work, and we are building what I think will ultimately be a really large internet site, nobility.org, and it, you know, there's, you go there to learn about the issues, and you can plug in the issue, you go there to learn about the Nobel laureates, to watch streaming video of the laureates talking about the issues. I mean, I'm in the process of editing about 60 more streaming clips of laureates, the footage that's not in the movie, because I have a lot more footage.
Sure.
I didn't use. I mean, we shot 160 hours, and the movie's an hour and a half, so a lot of that's on there, and it can get connected to your elected officials if you want to go take a stand that way, or you can get connected to groups that we think are working on the problems. But, you know, it is. The world centers around the internet these days.
It really does.
And,
although, if you know, I was going to ask you this question, Turk. Did Future Shock have anything? Was there any kind of vague recollection? Alvin Toffler's book.
Yeah, the book from, yeah, that's about 30. Yeah,
1970.
It may be. You know, it's probably been 30 years since I read Future Shock, and the premise of Future Shock is rapid change.
Too much change in too short a period of time, which is technology, the industrial age,
I wasn't consciously thinking of Future Shock, but you know, everything you read and everything you do and everything you see sinks into your consciousness, and it comes back in common ways. I was talking to a reporter a couple of days ago who asked me about Jody Williams, who is the founder of the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, and about her. You know, this was the first group ever to ban a weapon system. And
right.
They did it in a relatively short time. The United States hasn't signed, but the wide-ranging effects of most of the nations in the world signing this treaty and the tens of millions of landmines that are being destroyed and the tens of thousands of lives that are being saved and children who aren't losing limbs and being blinded, and the work, that the good that has come from Jody and the many other people that worked with her. She didn't do it solo, but... is really astounding. And I asked her a question in the film that was just off the cuff at the time. I said, is there another system of weapons that you guys could get rid of? And you could, you know, is this an example for other ways to go? And, you know, just in the last couple of weeks, I've been thinking about that question a lot, because we read about during the Lebanon-Israeli-Hezbollah war, about how terrible it was that Hezbollah was firing these rockets into Israel, and it was terrible that they were firing these rockets into Israel loaded with ball bearings, which were obviously anti-personnel. You know, and then after we learned, you know, of course, that the Israelis were firing rockets and artillery shells into Lebanon at Hezbollah, which are higher-tech versions of that, which are cluster bombs, which are also anti-personnel, which are essentially also loaded with ball bearings, although they're harder and they penetrate armor and they do a lot of other terrible things. And that large numbers of these things are unexploded. These munitions are unexploded all over Lebanon, and they are essentially now more lethal versions of landmines. Instead of killing or maiming one person who happens to set it off, somebody sets one off, it can have an enormous effects and rip through a neighborhood. And, you know, yes, there's a system of weapons that's very similar to a landmine that someone, Jody's group or someone else, could go after. And, you know, this reporter mentioned this to me after I'd been thinking about it basically for the last 2 weeks straight. And he said, after I saw Jody, I started thinking about cluster bombs. It occurs to me that someone who sees this film and sees this interview or reads his or reads about cluster bombs will go, yes, that's an issue I could work on.
Right.
There's an issue that's crying for somebody to work on it. These are weapons that serve no purpose whatsoever, and they need to be banned.
Right.
And somebody will make that happen.
Well, you know, even just taking something to a very minute grassroots level, just becoming involved with the ecological needs of your neighborhood.
Absolutely.
Not even your community, but just your neighborhood, and creating, you know, a mulch heap or something that simple. I mean, for me, one of the biggest issues is the transportation and elimination of waste with the overpopulation and the growth of the population, and how we junk our environment with all the junk we buy.
Yeah, it's really amazing. We are a nation of junk, leading the way to a world of junk. And it's not just the packaging and it's the stuff you don't need anyway, but then
the packaging.
And then the transportation costs and the things that we ship all over the world. You know, the fact that we ship water in heavy bottles all over the world, and rather than going to where the water is and treating it and making it nice and clean and drinking it there. And that's something you need, you know. If it's that wasteful and something you need, then what's it like for all the many things in the world that we don't need?
Right. So. One of my colleagues from the group I'm a member of, Emergency Arts, Scott Harrison, is involved with Charity Is, and just the simple drilling of wells. You know, there are something like a billion people that don't have fresh water on our planet. Something staggering.
Yeah, I actually think it's closer to 2 billion people Earth who don't have fresh drinking water. And, you know, we are building this water system in Kenya. You know, and I'm trying to find, you know, corporate support for these programs, or foundation support, or individual support for these programs. I mean, we can build one water system, but, you know, I mean, we're a very small nonprofit. There are thousands of schools in Kenya that don't have fresh water. These kids at St. Joseph's Mahiga, where I filmed, they're walking a mile and a half every day to get water, to water the trees that they're trying to grow around their school, and for drinking water at the school. And it's coming from an open stream. And they're sick all the time. And it's, you know, the right to fresh water is a basic human right that every person on earth shares the right to safety and to food and to fresh water. And it's an easy problem for us to solve worldwide. Now, having adequate water supplies at the rate we waste water in a lot of parts of the world, it may not be what we can provide to everybody, but fresh drinking water we can provide.
And I think young people don't realize the disease it's carried just from having animals that you domesticated animals that you use.
Well, rainwater rainwater is a great is one of the great solutions. Rainwater collection systems, you know, it's not, you know, like putting buckets out. You know, rainwater collection involves collecting water from, you know, roofs that don't have lead contamination in one thing or another on them, and there's a little diversion system that takes off the first flush of runoff, and you have 20 to 25,000 gallon water tanks to collect this water, and it's very pure water, and so there's a tendency to think in development projects, we'll just go spend some money, we're going to do this, we're going to drill a well everywhere. But if you drill a well everywhere, you've got groundwater issues, and rainwater is just coming down,
right?
And it's like the sun, and the solar energy thing is another big issue of this movie, or energy in general, and solar as being the big solution. Both rainwater and solar power are falling on this earth every day, and there's vast areas of the earth that don't have power and fresh water, and there's a pretty obvious place from where we should get them.
And wind, which is a little bit more cost prohibitive, but wind turbines are incredibly effective.
Well, Texas, for all its terrible reputation and as being a progressive state, is now the leader in wind power production, me being a Texan. And so it's one thing we've got going
I know some of the gentlemen that helped push that through.
And every state in this nation could be producing vast quantities of solar. And it's going to happen. It's just, it just could be happening so much more quickly, and the sooner it happens, the less fossil fuels we'll be burning in the long term, the less we'll be exacerbating the conditions of global warming. I mean, we are going towards solar in a very big ways, and it's time for government, corporations, and individuals to all wake up and recognize it, and to promote science education, to promote tax incentives, and to get people involved in this stuff. And I think that in some ways, one of the most moving parts of this film is Rick Smalley talking about the energy crisis, because we lost him since the interview was filmed, and it was his life's work was to solve the energy crisis for future generations.
Right,
and he got pretty close.
We interviewed Chris Payne, who killed the electric car, mm-hmm. and there's a great segment with a gentleman who's developed a lot of the fuel cells for the cars, but he's developed this micro thin solar film panel that you can lay right on your roof line, and it's I don't know if it's cost prohibitive at this stage, but it looked like it couldn't be any easier for any general contractor to get its crew to get your house
and that's the thing. There we're coming out now very rapidly with the integral roofing technologies, where the solar panels are actually part of what goes down on your roof. And I had dinner with Tommy Chong, Tommy Chong, a couple of weeks ago, and he told me that he has a guy in L.A. building him an electric lowrider. And he said, how when you open the back of the lowrider and it's all full of the speakers with the lights and the glow and everything, when you open mine, it's batteries and they glow.
That's great. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, Turk, did your celebrity, your acting career, did that help you land any of these people? Did you have to use that ace every once in a while?
I don't know.
You may have seen me on The Sopranos.
Yeah, it's a pretty small ace. The Sopranos it's a great role.
Yeah.
It was a great honor to have it, actually, and I owe David Chase a great debt of gratitude. And everybody at The Sopranos, I love working with them. But I played Aaron Arkaway, who was Janice's idiot narcoleptic boyfriend.
Right.
Now the narcolepsy seems to have, last time they had me back last season, I was just the right wing Christian trying to save Tony's soul and making a fool out of myself. But I don't think it hurts. Certainly, yeah. I have a weird career. I mean, I've written 10 books. I've written fiction and nonfiction. I write for magazines, and I act in television and film, and I direct. And so, which one of those is my focus? I don't know.
You're a Renaissance guy. That's why I said it.
Yeah,
no shame in saying that.
I could make, and unfortunately, being a Renaissance man is a low-paying gig. I could anybody out there who's,
It's not like the good old days when you were Leonardo da Vinci.
Well,
really.
For the last 5 years, I've been building a house. I mean, I tell people that, and they go, "Oh, that's cool, man." I've been building a house. I'm out there with a hammer and a saw, and the idea generally is that I'm writing a book about, Mr. Pipkin Builds His Dream House is the name of this, and it kind of opens with me digging these giant granite boulders out of the ground, just basically wishing I was dead, and pulling God's molars, as I describe it. but that's a low-paying gig, too, But I have an opportunity to sort of do what I want to do. It's a very rare thing in life.
Yeah. And Austin's a little bit easier city to do that in than L.A. or New York.
It was a lot easier to do it when I was a young man, when I was a I started as a street performer, and I was a comic. I was, you know.
That's right. You did a tour of duty with Rodney, right?
Yeah, a tour with Rodney Dangerfield. I used to tour with Willie. He was, you know, still Willie's got music in the film and has been a supporter. And Harry Anderson has been my partner for many years.
When he says Willie, he means Willie Nelson.
Willie Nelson. Willie's one of those guys you only need one name, okay, you know, yeah. I think.
I would agree with you.
And it... But it was easy back then. You didn't need much money. You know what I mean? You didn't have to worry about health care. You didn't have, kids.
We didn't have family.
You know, everybody, it's not even just the family. The world has really changed. It's gotten a lot more complicated than the last 20 years.
Right.
And so now you when you want to do what you want to do, you really have to be smart about it.
Right.
And when people ask me, you know, how do I become a writer? How do I become a director? How do I get in show business? Young people always, you know, and I just, all I can ever say is you just do it.
Right.
You tell me you're a writer, then when you show me something that's written, you're a writer. When you show me
you're
something you edited, you know, there is no key, you know. You can go to college if you want to go to college, but no one's ever going to ask you for that degree.
Right, right. Well, depending on whether or not you're a professional...
Well, no, if you want to do the weird things
surgeon.
I do, no one's going to ask you for the degree.
Well,
actually,
I
never asked my doctor, you know,
I was thinking that. It's on the wall. We just trust that he went to that university.
Oh, yeah.
And he got a degree.
Oh, they sell those. $20, you can get those diplomas on the internet.
Willie, did you meet Willie on the golf course? People don't know you're a great golfer as well. You've written a lot of golf books.
I actually met Willie Nelson on the golf course. Yeah,
who's got the better handicap?
You're talking about song. Well, Willie doesn't keep a handicap. Willie is way too cool to keep a handicap. Are you kidding me? Willie, you know, if Willie hits it.
Lots of mulligans?
If Willie hits it in the woods, it's not even a mulligan when it's with Willie. If Willie hits it in the woods, he just
it's a do-over?
Goes down there. No, he just walks down there wherever he thinks the ball should be and tosses it down on the ground. And that's the way it works. And then, you know, it's the most enjoyable game of golf. You know, people like to rank on Clinton or whoever, or, you know, Donald Trump or somebody because they cheat at golf.
Right.
I mean, you can't cheat at golf unless there is no cheating at golf. You can cheat the person you're playing against.
Right.
If you enter a tournament, you're cheating the tournament, you know.
Right.
But golf is whatever you want it to be. Golf is a ball and a stick, and you go hit that thing. And I don't know anybody that gets more joy out of it than Willie. I mean, it's the best sense of the game.
Did he bring anything to the film with his, I mean, you know, he's been using ethanol, right, on his tour bus?
Biodiesel, actually.
Biodiesel.
Willie has, Willie and I have a book out. It's called The Tao of Willie, or The Tao of Willie, T-A-O,
right.
Ancient Chinese philosophy. And it really is Willie's take on life and spirituality and music and politics and peace. It's really quite an amazing book. And so Willie had an effect on this movie just because we've been talking about this stuff for years. And I've worked with Farm Aid, and I've worked with him on other issues. But his biodiesel thing is amazing. And his wife Annie got him into using biodiesel in Hawaii, where they have to recycle all the deep fat fryer oil. And he's got a brand new Mercedes over there. They drove it, took it right from the lot to the biodiesel plant and said, fill it up.
The Mercedes guys. French fries down the road.
All the cops chase you, the dogs chase you down the road instead of the cops. And now he's got a biodiesel company. He's manufacturing biodiesel at his truck stop in Texas. He sells it all over the country. He and Morgan Freeman have got this company. They hired Julia Roberts as their spokesperson. I mean, how smart are they? It's a publicly traded stock. And Willie, as it turns out, ends up being a business guru after all the thing with the IRS. And he is, you know, the stuff he accomplishes and does in his life is amazing. There's a beautiful song called Whatever Happened to Peace on Earth that people should look for now on the internet.
Yeah, and that's in the movie, right? It's featured in the movie?
Well, the song he has in the movie, and the closing song of the movie is actually Willie singing Rainbow Connection, which is, of course, a Kermit song. But the song becomes so much larger
so much
when
poignant.
Willie sings it.
Yeah.
And it's about so much more. And it's an extraordinary. I intended to close this movie with John Lennon singing Imagine, and then there was a Willie version with Booker T of Imagine, and Willie offered to let me have that and use that, and I put that in there for a while, and then I said, I want to try Rainbow Connection. I always liked that song, and I had that version he'd recorded a few years ago and put it in there and just went, oh, that's it. So my movie is done.
The tear flooding.
There's never a dry eye in the house.
Yeah, you use that. Well placed. That's the actor-director in you. That's...
Talked about Landmark, Mark Cuban's company, Landmark Cinemas, is
right.
This opening the movie on Friday, the 8th of September in Boston and D.C. In Boston, we're at Landmarks Kendall Square Cinema, and in D.C., we're at the Landmarks E Street Cinema. And this Friday night, there's actually a great event there. Follows up our New York premiere with a memorial tribute to Sir Joseph Rotblat and with his group Student Pugwash USA. And Rotblat was a contemporary of Einstein. He's a nuclear physicist, and he basically Einstein left to him the mission of fighting nuclear proliferation, right. And he spent the next 50 years of his life in the battle. And I filmed this interview in the movie with him last year, and he had invited me to screen the movie at their 50th anniversary of Pugwash at Hiroshima on the 60th anniversary of the dropping of the bomb, and we weren't finished. I couldn't take the movie out, and it was heartbreaking to have to tell him that I couldn't get there, and he got sick and couldn't go, as it turned out, and passed away very shortly thereafter, tremendous loss. And I think his words in the movie about the dangers of nuclear weapons are more poignant than ever, and the dangers are, I think they were maybe being reduced in the world for a while, but obviously they're going the other direction. It's not just that Iran and North Korea want to build nuclear weapons, it's that we want to build. America is talking about building new generations of tactical nuclear weapons. They're talking about using them not as a last weapon of last defense, but as a first strike weapon. This is a complete change from any administration, any use of nuclear weapons, discussion of the use of nuclear weapons before, and it's pretty hard to argue that what we consider to be dangerous nations like Iran and North Korea or any nation in the world can't build nuclear weapons when we're still talking about building more, when there's 30,000 nuclear weapons in the arsenals, and there's one number of nuclear weapons there should be in the world, and that's zero.
Zero, right.
And we have agreements in place where we're going to continue to get rid of our nuclear weapons as we were for a very long time and reduce the number, as would the Russians. And we have agreements in place to process these materials and radioactive materials that come from the weapons and get them...
with a half shelf life of, 500,000 years. Uh-huh.
The key thing, though, is much as the danger of the long-term danger of the radiation is, the key thing is also to de-enrich them, is to mix them with non-fissionable materials,
right,
so that they can't be used if some terrorist group or another nation
suitcase
gets a hold
bomb
of them to use them in some kind of a suitcase bomb. And all of this process exists and is out there, and we just don't honor it anymore. We don't honor our treaties, and we talk about how the other countries in the world, they're not trustworthy, but the United States needs to honor their international agreements, and the only way it's going to happen is if Americans stand up and insist that it happens.
Well, I was going to say, who's going to police the superpowers? If the United Nations can't police and they're not effective or whatever it may be politically, who polices? Who says yes? Who says no? It's the
you
people.
And me. Yeah.
It's the people. The people's voice. Do you think we'll ever reach a day where the corporate boardrooms won't look at the bottom line, profit, and start to look at these bigger issues?
Well, I think that they'll always, the nature of corporations and capitalism is a bottom line, because that's what pays the bills and that's what keeps them in business. And I think that expecting them not to look at the bottom line is, there's a lot of old fables, some of them from Africa, about the hare and the jackal, or and the hare jumps on there's one with a scorpion, but the hare jumps on the jackal's back to take him across the river, and then he gets halfway across the river and, he eats him, and a jackal says you can't expect a jackal not to be a jackal. Now, I don't mean to say that corporations are jackals, but everybody has their own nature, and corporations are built according to a nature. I think that the key is to show corporations that they have long-term economic interests as well as interests as fellow human beings.
Right.
And as individuals, and as the corporations are a part of society, so they have a lot of varied interests, one of which is their bottom line. But, when it comes to the energy crisis, I don't think that there's any question that big energy companies and big manufacturing companies are going to be a big part of solving the energy crisis. And the sooner they wake up to that, the bigger piece of the pie they're going to have in long term. And there's this tendency to say, if it's going to be solar, you can't own the sun.
Right.
But
you can own the technology.
You can own the technology.
Yeah,
and you can build the panels, and you can install the panels, and you can be the company that transmits the power and sells the power. You can be the company that builds the appliances, which is giant, basically a giant battery, which will one day be in all of our homes, in the vision of Rick Smalley, and I believe that he was right, so that solar that's generated in the day will have a place to be stored at night. We'll have a little computer that'll buy our power at the time of day from the grid that it's the cheapest, and the time of the day it's the cheapest will be the daytime when the solar panels are all generating. And, you know, GE and Westinghouse will be the companies making the, it'll be like we all have another refrigerator we have to buy, and they'll be making money on it. And when they see that,
and the maintenance and everything else that goes along with it,
and when they see that, they'll see how they fit into the long-term, you know, green approach to saving this planet, as opposed to the approach we have right now, which is let's bury our heads in the sand and hope it's not as bad as we all fear it will be.
I like the term the inconvenient truth.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it sums it up. No one wants to look at the truth. It's too terrifying, it's too inconvenient, whatever it may be.
Yeah, and you know, corporations, they're gonna find that it's gonna be inconvenient to not be a part of the solution. And the truth of the matter is, the answers are out there to most of these problems, and it's great to have these Nobel laureates and nobility giving them to us. There's a lot of other places you can get great knowledge and great answers, but we've got to rely on this, and we've got to start to work on these issues, or future generations. We really are going to be the first generation to say, you know, it got better and better and better up to the time we were alive, and then, I don't know, we were having fun, or I don't know what it was. It just got complicated, and we dropped the ball, and we hoped it wouldn't be as bad as it is, but guess what? It is. And so it's every person in America, every person in the world has got to say to themselves, okay, what's important to me? What is it about my life that is part of the problem? What is it about my life that could be part of a solution? And you'll find yourself more richly rewarded by the way you live your life and the things you do for other people and you do towards these solutions than you could possibly be by how you're rewarded by being a consumer or by watching more TV or whatever it is we all do with our time.
Well, I mean, I think personally for me, I'd love to see America be the number one exporter of this new technology instead of having movies and...
Well, we've always been a great exporter of technology, and we need to be supporter of, you know, of science and of education in general, and we need to be the beacon of freedom that we always have been looked to by the rest of the world to be. The rest of the world is still very hopeful and still very much in love with the idea of America, and now the question is, are we going to be able to live up to their hopes and expectations and our own? And I don't think, you know, we can assume just because we're a place called America that everything about us is great. We've got these fantastic founding documents, and we have a people that love freedom. And now the question is, what will we do with it?
Right. Turk, I want to thank you for being on the Culture Catch. Anyone that sees the movie, it'll be an education they'll never forget. And I hope that people in the small community have an opportunity. Small communities all over the globe have an opportunity to see this.
Absolutely, and you can. If you want to learn more about the nonprofit, nobility.org. You want to schedule a screening in your town, nobilitythemovie.com. And if you want to get the DVD, you can get it purchased in advance. But it'll be out on November 21st. So.
At all your local Amazons. And
Everywhere.
Everywhere. It's Nobility.
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 It's a movie.
All right. And look for, we're going to show some excerpts on the site as well.
Fantastic.
Thanks again. We'll see you soon. I'd like to thank our sponsors today, FinalDraft.com. You've got a script to write? FinalDraft.com's got the software. And Script Magazine. If you're a screenplay writer, you need to be reading Script Magazine. Check them out at ScriptMag.com. That's ScriptMag.com. Converge is the word. Okay.